BingeBots.
Hi, I'm Samiran.
Hi, I'm Nilesh.
Hi, I'm Sheetal. And you're listening to 3TB.
Three Techies Banter.
In this episode, we are, you know, happy and fortunate to have Shankar Marwara with us. Shankar is probably one of those people who's been in the background and also led one of the, a non-techie who's kind of led one of the most complex technology programs the country has ever embarked on, which is Aadhaar, UPI, and of course his pet project, which is in the area of education. So he leads Ekstep. In fact, when I was just going through the wonderful Ekstep story, I couldn't help but think about, you know, the nuns in the abbey in Sound of Music who were saying, how do you solve a problem like Maria? And that seemed to be their biggest problem. And now, you know, so how do you really solve problems, you know, at this scale, be it education, be it health, be it identity? And I think what Shankar and the team that works with him has kind of made us and all Indians believe is that, you know, we can, you know, think differently and, you know, make a, you know, leapfrog technology, make a big difference to everything around us. Before I kind of jump and ask Shankar the one question, I think a little bit of trivia that I picked up from one of his interviews is the fact that while he claims to be a non-techie, he is the one who is responsible for the name Aadhaar. So he is the one. So if you don't like it, then he's the one, but Aadhaar is the one. And I think he was so immersed in Aadhaar is that the third word that his younger son learned after mom and dad was Aadhaar. So that's how deeply he was involved in this. So welcome, Shankar. It's a real, real pleasure and a privilege to have you on the show. So I'm going to just start off by, you know, I'm not going to kind of go into the problem, the numbers and all. But I think there's one of the things that you promote and that whole team brings to the table, you know, where you have this whole concept of one plus thinking, you know, that the fact that the whole ecosystem needs to change. So while you may do a lot of things, everybody else also needs to do something so that it becomes irreversible. So in your journey, as far as Ekstep is concerned, what was that one plus moment that you felt happened that shifted the lever and made all of that you were doing possible?
Yeah, thank you, Samiran. Great to be on the podcast. Firstly, OnePlus is a mobile brand. We call it Plus One. And the logic for it is change is incredibly hard, especially when you have to go through it. So when you're trying to bring about change at a systemic scale, nobody wants to change, right? So if you can design technology-based solutions and systems such that as part of their day-to-day lives, they just have to take one small extra step. But in return for paying that cost of taking that one extra step, they get a lot of benefit. They have that aha moment. So the value of that transaction weighs on the side of them wanting it and repeating that behavior. So we define Plus One as mind opening yet familiar, right? Or somebody else calls it radical yet practical. Now, for that to happen at the level of a massive ecosystem, I'll give you an example of an energized textbook. The idea was, how do you connect physical content that people trust and use in a day-to-day basis to digital content? And therefore, understanding how that ecosystem works. How is the textbook published? How is the content in the textbook decided? How is the textbook used in classes? How is it distributed? What are all the things that people do? What are the day-to-day routines? Or in the case of textbook publishing, annual routines. And therefore, designing a solution such that every person has to do just one extra job. The printer is anyway printing the same books. The textbook creator is anyway designing everything. So just put a QR code at a spot. You anyway have authorized institutions that are supposed to think about digital content. They should be worrying about the digital content. And then you anyway have teachers referring to the textbooks in class. Teachers anyway have mobile phones, smartphones, right? And when a child is going through a textbook, they see the QR code, it signals that, hey, behind me is some digital content. Do you want to try it? So it took us around 6 months of effort, intensive effort, to make it plus one with respect to converting textbooks into energized textbooks. As a result of that design implementation on Diksha, currently there are more than 600 million textbooks printed by 30 plus states autonomously. And people are using it like, you know, the way we used to making UPI payments. So there's a lot of counterintuitiveness goes into plus one thinking.
Shankar, I know we jumped into the conversation, but I think one thing that I want to ask you is, maybe our average listener is not as familiar with Ekstep and is not as familiar with Sunbird. And I just want you to, in layman terms, tell our audience, our viewers and our listeners, what is it that Ekstep is doing? I know you're talking about educating 200 million students by the year 2025. I think that's what you've mentioned. And I know you're well on your way. 2020, sorry. And you've already crossed that and you're doing much more now. And I know your future vision is really about saying that the problem of primary school education should not exist in the country by the time it's 2030. But I think it would be nice for our listeners and our viewers to get a sense of what is it that Ekstep does, in short, easy to understand terminology. And, you know, if you can give us an equivalent of, like you said, that if you take that plus one step and it's that plus one gives you a lot back. Aadhaar, everybody has heard, we've read about the Aadhaar effect. Tell us what the effect for education is and where do you think people will start suddenly seeing, oh my God, we didn't even realize this and this has happened in the country. So if you can kind of put that perspective and then we'll go.
And maybe you should also tell us what Ekstep is not, because then sometimes people tend to think, oh, this is going to solve everything. It's probably going to bring education and put implanted right in my head now.
Yeah. So I think before talking about why we set out to do what we set out to do, the question of who are we and why did we come together? So at a fundamental level, we were a group of people who had undergone a transformational journey called Aadhaar, which was led by Nandan Nilekani. And then in 2015, the same group came together. Rohini Nilekani was also a co-founder of Ekstep. The question was, like with Aadhaar, can we do something in primary education? When I say like with Aadhaar, I mean thinking big, thinking urgent, thinking the identity as an infrastructure which enables others to do things. Thinking how technology can be a valuable enabler or a tool to improve people's lives. So there were a bunch of kind of Aadhaar playbook that we had in mind as a starting point. So when we turned our attention to education, this was as a philanthropy. It was entirely funded by Nandan and Rohini. Aadhaar was as part of government. So the problem definition here was, as a country, thanks to the wonderful efforts of the past over the past three decades, we have solved schooling as a problem. Three decades ago, we had a problem that our kids are not in school. We don't discuss that anymore. But as a result, it has created a problem called learning. Lot more children in school, but they're not learning. As evidenced in the multiple surveys that come out, starting from ASSAR, from Pratham to Government of India's. How do we solve for that learning crisis? That was the starting point. And part of our thinking is, how do you meet the problem at the scale and complexity that it is, rather than constrained by our resources and our teams? So therefore, we said, okay, there are 250 million children. Maybe 200 million is a good number. Let's go after 200 million children. But that's incomplete because you can achieve it in 20 years. Let's gun for 2020, around 5+ years. So 200 million children over from 2015 to 2020, so 5+ years, and increase the access of these children to learning opportunity. And that's important to who we are. We believe if every individual has access to opportunities, if every individual has the choice that will be transformational for the country. Whether it is access to proving your identity, Aadhaar, access to easy, convenient payments with choice, UPI, access to learning opportunities, which means when I want to learn, I have access to ways of learning. So in some ways, and you know, Nandan proudly likes to say that we see ourselves as plumbers. We lay down the infrastructure. That's what we are good at, which allows others to build on top. Now, education is way more complex than identity in others. It's because unlike identity or finance, which are transactions, you prove an identity, you make a payment. Education is not a transaction, but a social interaction, an interaction that is over a decade and a half. So it took us some time to understand the complexity. Thankfully, Rohini knew the sector much better than us. So she was kind of cautioning that, you know, you can't, technologies won't be the magic bullet here. There's so many other complexities. And once we realized that, we asked ourselves, what is infrastructural thinking in education? Because, you know, I'm talking 2015, 16. That time, the world was divided into two groups of people. Champions of EdTech and those who were fearful or hated EdTech. Neatly divided, right? And we realized both camps were right from their point of view. But what was missing was a conversation on a fundamental infrastructure which could power EdTech solutions, but could also power non-EdTech solutions. And that led us to asking the question of how do we think about infrastructure in the context of education? So, if you have a question, Sita.
Yeah, so Shankar, I just want to interject and say, if you had to think about the three big problems that came up when you said, what are the issues, right? Because when you're talking money and you're talking finance, you're talking transactions. But here it's, I'm sure it is language, which could be a challenge. It would be other things which were challenges. What were the three big challenges that you faced, which could have been solved by technology, but were not the obvious ones to be solved by technology?
It's a great question. See, the first was going back to access. If the only teaching learning material that a child has is the textbook, one type of children, other children have access to all kinds of books and all kinds of digital material and tuition teachers and well-educated parents, the first child has a massive disadvantage. So if you see what WhatsApp did, doesn't matter who you are, everybody uses WhatsApp. It democratizes access to communication. What Google did, the search, no matter who you are, you will use Google because it democratized access to knowledge. So the power of technology to democratize. So when I want to know more about photosynthesis and my textbook covers only two paragraphs, I have a problem if I don't have access to other things. If I'm not the kind of reader who learns by reading, but I learn by watching, hearing, I'm at a disadvantage because I only have a textbook. So given that learning is intensely personal, but standardized ways of providing content, we could break that shackle through technology. A second big thing, teacher training. Given that in the public sector, 80 to 90% of state government's budgets go into teacher salaries, the budgets for teacher training are down that much. As a result, only around 15 to 20% of teachers in a state used to get trained once a year. So teacher training is a very important component. It is continuous. It has to be continuous. If only 20% of your teachers are getting trained a year, once a year, and that's because it's face-to-face, you spend a week, spend a day going somewhere, coming back. When you need to use that knowledge, you might have forgotten it. What if teacher training was available on tap to the teacher? That was the second big challenge. Third, administrative authorities can only govern when they are seeing what's going on. And to see, they need to get data on pretty much what's happening. What kind of content are children liking? How are teachers consuming training? In the physical world, that is difficult. So can administrators get data about the learning process, about the training process, so that they can deploy more resources or divert resources from where it is not needed to where it is? So I gave you three user types, the child or the learner, the teacher and the administrator. Likewise, there are parents. So with each, So parents really don't know how well the child is doing except the report card. And Asar survey showed that. So since I come from a marketing background, it was instinctive that, you know, talk to the consumers, find out what they're doing. What's the problem behind the problem? Not the problem, the state. And that's when we realized that there's a role for technology to act as an infrastructure. And then we came up with an analogy as to it's what we're talking about is not unusual. This is how we have solved large, complex problems. Think of your car. Did the person who made the road make the car? Somebody laid down the roads, right? You have appliances. Are they generating the electricity, right? So infrastructure is how, as a civilization, we have solved many large, complex problems, where the nature of problem varies depending upon the context. And therefore, the solution also varies. I can't say that you have to go in a three-wheeled car or in a four-wheeled car. That's for you.
In fact, what I liked about what you said also, that this providing the capability to everyone an equal opportunity to kind of grow so that one group is not advantaged or disadvantaged. So, in fact, I love that the other analogies that I came across that you have used earlier is that, you know, it, how you are enabling Tony Starks to become Iron Man as opposed to the Superman, a person who's born with all abilities versus a person who can be taught and nurtured and made to become different, you know, so which was kind of, I thought, was very interesting. So the other one, I thought, on the technology piece, you know, which may or may not be directly extra related, but it's got to do with democratization, is this whole thing about language. And I think, you know, this whole thing that you guys are working with on this AI for Bharat, you know, is this ability for us as Indians, you know, our biggest challenge is obviously this diversity. Everybody speaks a different language, dialects, what have you. Now, imagine a situation where anyone can talk to anyone and anyone can understand what the other person is saying, has huge ramifications, obviously, for national integration at a very, very large scale, but obviously at a narrower teaching, right? Which means that anyone can teach anyone else. Of course, you may lose some context, but the fact that if you are able to bridge this gap, it'll be fantastic. So I know you guys are doing some work with them and Nandan's probably funded, but is that in any way playing into your education thing or is that something?
It is very much playing because, you know, when you're thinking infrastructure, what you're trying to do is take one small thing, enabling that at massive scale. Aadhaar, prove identity, nothing else, but the scale of 1.3 billion, right? The Energize textbook, connect physical to digital in a trusted manner, so that local content can be created, that's all. And boom, many. So when you're doing that slice by slice, you're not trying to solve the analogy is this. A car is made of thousands of parts, right? You're kind of saying, okay, steering wheel. Here is how to create a steering wheel. Any kind of steering wheel can be created. Here is how you create a tire, many, right? So as we are working through the set of problems, then in around 2019, Nandan realized that the way artificial intelligence is going, the way we are seeing language as a barrier, maybe there might be something we could and should do about that. Then we got a former Aadhaar colleague, Vivek Raghavan. He identified these professors in AI for Bharat. And then we also got a call from the Ministry of Information Technology that, you know, it seems you're working in this area, can we partner? But essentially, the same playbook was applied there. What's the language stack? What is needed? If you think of AI in language as infrastructure, what is needed there? And then we realized that the various use cases of language need not always be in learning. WhatsApp, a lot of illiterate people use it because they can speak to it, record a voice message and go, right? Imagine the power of the parents of a illiterate parents of a girl child who has a scholarship to just ask, does my child get a scholarship? How do I go about it? If I can talk to someone, that's what happens, right? I talk to the local village chacha who knows about it and will tell me. So imagine if that village chacha was on the phone. Phones are much more ubiquitous now than 2015. What if there's so many dialects? In Uttar Pradesh, you say the word talab or pukur for lake, depending upon which side of the, you know, east or west. When every state, the language changes, right? So I'm telling a story about pukur, pukur, pukur. You don't understand pukur. At that point, it says, oh, sorry, pukur, talab for you, right? Or bag, this is what it means. What we realized is not being able to communicate in the right language lowers people's self-esteem. When you read in a language you're not that comfortable with, the cognitive load on your mind shoots up a lot, right? And at that time, you just need a little help. Some of the more complex words, you need a help, right? So we tried to break down the problem of language into very, very many micro problems and asking which of that problem could be solved how. But the encouraging part was AI for Bharat, they said that, look, whatever we do, we're going to be focused on Indian languages. And whatever our work is, will always be open source. Those were the two things we were, you know, really excited by. And wonderful group of people. Over the last year, so many others have joined, right? It is like a massive ecosystem coming together. I want to break the notion that one organization, bunch of bright people come and solve world's problems. Not happening.
In fact, my next question is actually linked to what you just said. So, you know, you've created stacks. So you have a tech stack and you have an education stack and you have a language stack and you have all kinds of stacks. I just want to understand, are there any use cases which you all never anticipated when you all created these stacks, which now some really bright young entrepreneurs have come and said, we can do this with your stack?
So there's these famous stories we hear, right, about those life boys being used to wash buffaloes and lassis being made in washing machines. So did you have any such moments?
Yeah, actually, it's a moment that has an implication for both of you. I told you about QR codes and textbooks, right? There's a lot of thought went into it. I oversimplified it. But the technology behind it was made for massive scale and for diverse use cases because we didn't know who would use it for what. So when teacher training came, there was a need to verify that, did you actually go through this training? So the same technology was repurposed to give a digitally verifiable credential. So in your training certificate, everything is the same. There's a QR code. So when you use an app and try to verify it, the person who gave the training is verifying that, yes, I did indeed give it. That worked. And then COVID came. People said that, look, I need to show that this person who is vaccinated is indeed vaccinated. Said, okay, the same idea could maybe work here. So somebody else took it. And that's why your COVID certificate has the little bit of the same technology in the form of a big QR code, which is there in the textbook of the small child who's using it to get digital content. So that was a case where as a country, we got lucky. Has there been any? So one use case is this. When ChatGPT was released, Bhashini was already there. Bhashini is a government of India project. And so we had already had this open source models of Indian language. Within 4 weeks, researchers put Bhashini on top of ChatGPT and released a bot called Jugalbandi, which when Satya Nadella saw in early Jan, it blew his mind as to how fast innovation is traveling from the Valley to India and with the potential from Bangalore or Delhi or Chennai to millions of farmers very quickly. So those are the moments that gives you goosebumps.
That's fantastic. In fact, when I was at IBM, the IBM research team was toying with this idea. So they had this whole concept, this thing called spoken web. So the whole thing about illiteracy, that, you know, they were trying to construct an alternative internet, if you will, for, you know, which could be speech driven with as simple things as even IVRs and also, you know, so you don't have to know numerics to type, you can say and talk. But I guess the thinking was right, but probably the tooling or this thing was wrong. But yeah,
few other use cases is not of technology, but how the solution is being used in India in ways that you could not have predicted. So this QR code textbook was there, right? So in Tamil Nadu, we heard the story of a teacher who converted it into a personalized solution. How? He would realize that child Ravi is weak in a particular topic. He would take a photocopy of the QR coded page, cut out the QR code, stick the QR code on the back of the child's ID, and would say, go use your father's phone and revise this content and tell your father that he needs to help you with this. It became a system of personalized learning created by the teacher. In Hyderabad, some affordable private school, government had come up with this bunch of quizzes at the end of every chapter. So this teacher, and this is narrated by this teacher who's the mother of someone we know, she was a substitute teacher, so she didn't know what the early teacher was exactly doing. She finished that chapter. She was about to go to the next chapter. The children said, hold on, miss. We are supposed to do the quiz. Make us do the quiz. Only then can you go to the next. So going back to Sheetal, your question of, so what has it really done? In some ways, number one, it has changed the relationship of teachers and children with the textbook. A textbook is no longer some pieces of a dead tree with ink. It's a gateway to digital knowledge. For teachers, all the training, and by the way, since 2020, around 6-7 million teachers have undergone more than 130 million courses, credential and all that. So the relationship of the teachers with professional development, and that to us is the real gratifying power of technology. It changes relationships of people with each other. It democratizes certain things. It creates a level playing field. And that's what keeps us going.
So it's very interesting because I know that there was struggle before the pandemic, and then the pandemic became a tipping point. And today you have, what, 60 billion minutes of learning, which has happened, right? And I'm not even thinking about the infrastructure you need to support that. And I believe in one of your conversations, you've said that it has never broken down. So that's kudos. But I'm just trying to understand that, you know, a lot of things which are happening at scale, there is always, and Saviran keeps talking about this, there must be something which has to tip it, right? Was COVID and that the tipping point for you? Or did you think that this would tip maybe a little later, but it would at some point in time gain very, very quick traction amongst people? And what's your learning there?
So a few tipping points. First was when we did our research and we realized that this energized textbooks is a winner of an idea. When the first three states who saw it, they said, we want this. So within a year, around 7 to 8 states took that up. But here's a clarification I want to make. Those 60, 61 billion minutes, they got nothing to do with Ekstep Foundation. They are 61 billion minutes on Diksha. Diksha is India's national education platform, school education platform.
On Diksha, correct.
What Ekstep did was create the underlying infrastructure called Sunbird.
Yes.
It's like we have Linux, open source software called Sunbird, which was what Diksha was built on. So Google can take Linux, create its own operating system called Chromium. Chromium belongs to Google. Linux is open source. So we created Sunbird because we believe that one solution may not be enough. So the second tipping, point was Diksha was launched in 2017 by the then vice president. In the next 7-8 months, 7 states came on. And these are not necessarily a type of state from one part of India. Maharashtra, Andhra, Tamil Nadu, the developed states first. Then Uttar Pradesh, Kashmir, Rajasthan, Assam. When this happened, everybody woke up to the possibility of, oh, this is big. So that was one tipping point. After that, over the next year, another 15 odd states came. A second tipping point was when we met the Honorable Prime Minister in August 2019, and he was very engaged. He wanted to understand how this happened, and you know, we were there with the ministry and all this. He asked Nandan personally, can you help me do this for civil servants? So there is now a platform called IGOT, Integrated Government Online Training, which is like the Diksha and more for civil servants, which is riding on the same digital infrastructure, Sunbird. Belongs to another government department run by a different set of people, nothing to do with us. Agriculture Ministry has started something. So this multiplier effect, that whole seed becoming a forest, right? There are multiple tipping points like this, but pandemic, COVID was obviously one. So when schooling was shut, learning could continue. And in those, at least the first few months, Diksha was among the top app, EdTech app, some weeks ahead of Vedantu, Baiju, some weeks below them, but in the top 5. That's when it was EdTech became something from a luxury to a necessity for a lot of governments. Yeah, but yeah, these are some of the tipping points that I can think of.
Just to kind of then take that forward, the fact that this thing can be used to build anything you want with variations and all that. So in the case of UPI, we have seen it has been the genesis of all kinds of unicorns. You know, people are built on top of it. Is that also happening with Sunbird? I mean, like Diksha is probably one instantiation of the Sunbird platform. But are there other, maybe EdTechs out there or other companies who are using different blocks of the Sunbird bouquet and building something. And the second question, which is I want to kind of get your sense on, you know, there is this always this feeling, and whether rightly or wrongly, that it's very difficult to work with the government. Let's stay away from that. Let's not do that. Let's do our own thing. Let's keep them at arm's length. But you guys have repeatedly demonstrated how it is possible to work and then, you know, make them champions of the cause. You know, I mean, it's like, I'm sure, you know, if we went around trying to give Aadhaar to everybody, it's never going to happen because it has to come by dictate, by sovereign guarantee, same as the case. What has been your secret source of success with working with the government? Because that's the thing that everybody consciously stays away from. You know,
you used an interesting phrase, Samiran, make them the champions of the cause, right? We don't need to because they are the champions of the cause, right? We're just acknowledging it. And when you start with the mindset that you can't serve 1.3 billion people the way in the private sector, right? Not when you are funded by the taxpayers. The life of a government officer is extremely difficult. The level of transparency, they have to be open to any kind of stakeholder because, you know, they're meant to serve. But the scale, the diversity, the constraints with which they work, which we saw ourselves at first hand when we were part of Aadhaar, has given us a unique sensitivity to the life of a government officer, to the challenges of governance, to the scale and diversity of the country. And it's like parenthood, right? Once you've been through it, you appreciate someone else, right? Okay, yeah. They are the champions. And when your quest is not to become a champion, your quest is to solve a problem, you obviously want to work with the champions. If you want to solve it at that scale, and everybody does not need to solve it at massive scale. There is wonderful work being done by a whole lot of organizations who are doing at a local level. They choose to work with local government or not. Everything is needed. But like us, we set a goal of 200 million. The people who think at that scale is government. Then, as Rohini says, you have to work with Bazaar, Samaj and Sarkar. They're three pillars of society. Now, so working for us, working with government was an easy option. Of course, working with government is never easy. But the fact that we had to work with government was a no-brainer. But again, working with government is easy or difficult based on your outlook, Samiran. Nobody is trying to be difficult with you, right? But there's so many fly-by-night operators that governments deal with. And as a government officer told me, we have NGOs coming and doing this much of work and claiming this much of credit.
Right. And as you were telling me, I think it just also as much of a issue of trust from their side. I mean, you know, you have to be credible to them, you know, because obviously, just as you mentioned, the canvas for them is so large. There must be thousands of people trying to peddle solutions or saying, I can solve this and all that. So I think that once they trust, I think then they're kind of all in, literally.
Yeah. And that trust cannot be developed overnight.
No, absolutely. I agree. That is very true.
And but yeah. It's not easy, but hey, nobody said solving for 1.3 billion was easy. At least I haven't got that memo yet.
No, absolutely. No, and I think that's what is kind of becoming a calling card, right? And the fact that if you're doing it for 1.3 billion, that is a big source of a talk every forum for everything, right? I mean, like we were in Ireland and the ambassador there wanted to kind of, was talking to his counterparts in Ireland about how UPI can be used. And he was struggling in the reverse. He was saying, you know, this solved 1.3 billion. Leon, ye 5 million ka kya karu main? You know, how do we solve?
Rounding of error.
Shankar, as an organization which believes that, you know, y'all are going to create the platforms and the rails on which, you know, trains can move, etc. How do you measure impact for yourselves? And I know in one of the conversations you said, fortunately, both Rohini and Nandan Nilekani don't think of impact in the traditional way that NGOs look at impact. How do you account for, because there is obviously, I mean, y'all are doing a lot of work and I'm sure that there is some amount of measurement that even you all must be putting into place. Number is one, right? We said we would do 200 million and we did 200 million. That's one way of looking at it. But are there other interesting ways to look at impact, which I think the NGOs can learn from if they were to listen to this conversation, to just get a sense of, you know, it's not just the number of bodies that you have physically impacted or whatever.
That's a great question, Sheetal. And we asked ourselves that maybe if you want to look at a metric like return on investment, in the for-profit world, it's simple. I put in 100 rupees, does it become 120 after a year? Does it become 1,000 after 10 years? So what we asked ourselves was, what is an equivalent metric in the philanthropic world? And here is what we came up with. India spends close to $200 billion as a country on education. And our budget is, say, in the order of $10-15 million. What if the money we spend creates infrastructure that improves productivity of $200 billion of spend, right? So that was, and how do we calculate it? We spent a certain money X on Sunbird. Government spent money on Diksha. But importantly, government is leveraging the teachers who are already being paid for, making them more effective. Government is leveraging the money on textbooks, connecting it to digital content, and making an impact on the child's learning process. So can we measure if it has it increased any productivity? Not yet. But by and large, it feels right. However, again, even in Aadhaar, the debate used to be, how do you know you're creating value? At that time, it was seems to be the right thing to do. But now there are studies that show that it has saved $27 billion of money every year, and the total money spent on it is $1.5 billion. Right? So decent rate of return. So we don't have at yet definitive studies, but I was on a podcast with the World Bank lead for education in India, Shabnam Sinha. And she was saying that at the start of the pandemic, or just before that, World Bank had done a global study of learning poverty. They define it as 100 means no kid is learning, 0 means everybody is okay. And India was at around 54, which is slightly lower in a good way than the lower middle income countries. Now, they estimated that that number of 54 could drop to 70 as a result of school closures. But it dropped down to 56 or something, just very little. She believes a lot of it had to do with India's policies, the implementation by teachers, and the wonderful effort everyone did, but also to Diksha in schooling. Right? Can she prove it? There's no proof as such. But we also do some qualitative studies. We hear from the states. But the bigger proof of the pudding is the usage. If you have to quantify, it's quite reasonable, right? But that's how we kind of say, yeah, you know, this it about sounds okay. But full credit to Nandan and Rohini, right? They're unlike any other philanthropist in this regard.
Okay. So before we wrap up, one question for you. As you look into the future, and here's a country which is struggling with what we call job-ready people. We've constantly been battling this with saying that we have education, but we are not creating a job-ready workforce. How do you see Sunbird, the platform, and all of the work that you guys are doing in terms of it being leveraged by someone to create a job-ready workforce?
Great question. Like with anything else, technology is only part of the solution. So there are a lot of, for example, I'm part of the National Steering Committee for changing our curriculum, the National Curriculum Framework for School Education. And there the emphasis, as per the National Education Policy, is to shift from knowledge, content to competencies and the process of learning. Because 21st century, that's what is needed. So there's going to be a policy component. Therefore, as a result of that, 5, 10, 15 years from now, nobody will care how much you know. They will value what you can do with it. How do you judge competency? And once you have judged competency, suppose it's a skill, right? Suppose Samiran says that Sheetal is great at a certain skill. He is willing to put a stamp. How does Sheetal prove that Samiran said I was great? Digitally verifiable credentials could do the job. Trust is again something that the poor have to fight to access, to prove. So solving for trusted credentials and solving for discovery of opportunities, jobs, training, courses, internships, or on the other side, discovering those who have the right credentials that you need in my neighborhood. And you have the beckon protocol that's been created by FIDE. Can some of those be leveraged? And what India is doing very well is creating all of these as building blocks, almost like separate blocks, which can be combined to make many, many, many more solutions. So Aadhaar plus UPI plus DigiLocker plus Cowin plus Sunbird plus GSTN, all of these are there and more will be there. So when they come together, but the principles remain same, Sheetal. Currently difficult to establish trust, make that easy. Small micro thing, massive scale. Currently difficult to discover, make that easy. Small thing at massive scale. Difficult to pay, we solved that. Difficult to prove ID, solve that. Nobody talks about it. Right? Difficult to prove competence, yeah. What do you mean by competence? You need policy. Once you have that, technology can help in the rest of it. So that's why we see the next 5-7 years as very, very exciting. While on the one hand, we have to still think about what's the kind of disruption AI will create. It will democratize and disrupt. It's one of those unusual things. What are the downsides of it? Whole bunch of things. But I think as a country, India showcased over the last decade plus that there's a way we can use technology to solve complex problems in a way that is that the playbook seems repeatable. The playbook seems to solve for inclusion and innovation. And other countries are looking at how, can Diksha be reused there? Can Sunbird be reused there? And that's a moment of pride, but also an acknowledgement that there's still a lot that needs to be done in the next 5 years.
So the one only thing I think, Shankar, I think I missed kind of coming back to that, on who's building on top of Sunbird, are people now using parts, combining them and doing something maybe in edtech, maybe in agriculture, maybe in health, or completely different areas?
Yeah. So as I said, one example was, so it's happening in three ways. One is certain building blocks of Sunbird being reused by others. Sunbird RC was used in Cowin. Sunbird Observe is being used to get automatic telemetry by a technology provider for certain corporates. I think NIIT is using it for some clients of theirs. So they're using certain parts of it. Companies like Infosys have taken Sunbird, build their own platforms on top. A company called TakeID is offering Sunbird-based solutions as a platform as a service. So NGOs who don't have a lot of technology or funds, they can just get that Sunbird as a service. And NGOs like Educate Girls, if you know them, right? And a few others. So there are early days, but there are some examples. But in a sense, going forward, that's what Ekstra will focus a lot on. Getting a lot more innovation on Sunbird. Because thus far, we've been very tied up in with helping the government set up Diksha, helping them manage it. And that's kind of stable. There'll be continuous innovations on top. And also, say, iGOT and other such things. But now, we feel that the opportunity is much larger. Other countries want it. Other departments want it. Certain for-profit, like I think Veranda Learning, they're looking at. They have a whole bunch of companies. So Sunbird architecture suits them to add on more and more companies onto it.
So how does this tie up with this? I know there's another component of this whole thing, which is societal platforms, right? So is that also kind of a different kind of a Lego version, like, breakdown of the same thing? Or is it a completely different?
So the origin of societal platform, now called societal thinking, lay in creating a playbook for how this way of working comes together. And that's how it started in 2016 when Sanjay Purohit came on board. But from then, it has gone on from strength to strength to articulate a larger playbook of how large-scale, complex societal problems, which cannot be solved by any one pillar of society, and climate change is the latest in that, how do we come together? What's the playbook for that? So they work with a lot of other organizations. I mean, they are part of Ekstep Foundation, but they work with a lot of other organizations because they are not involved in the day-to-day operations of, say, Diksha or Sunbird. They are focused on bottling this wisdom from Ekstep, from many other organizations, sharing it with others. And there are many organizations they learn from and teach to, so that that body of knowledge, all of which is, again, open source, available on societal platforms, societal thinking website, that is available for others to use.
No, in fact, when you hear with so many interviews and with the problem with the internet, there's so much information out there that you feel, what new can I get out of this? But, you know, I think we always are pleasantly surprised that there is so much more. There is just so many different ways of looking at something, which I think is just, I think it's interesting for us. And hopefully if it's interesting for us, I think, hope it's interesting for the people who listen also. So I think that's always refreshing that, you know, that with so much information and so many times the same thing being said, there is still new things to discover.
Shankar, thank you so much for joining us today. I think we've had an absolutely wonderful time having this conversation with you. I hope you enjoyed the banter as much. And I know we've taken up a little more time than we planned to, but thank you so much for your patience and for being here with us today.
Thank you, Sheetal. Thank you, Samiran. I love the idea of the podcast and the fact that it's a casual conversation. I enjoyed talking to you and hope the listeners take something out from it.